You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of War of the Rosé by Mark Seal. As the war over the kids dragged on, an equally nasty custody battle erupted over Miraval. Dear Brad, Jolie emailed Pitt on January 21st, 2021, I have reached a painful decision with a heavy heart. She began with the good, how excited she'd been to buy Miraval, her fond memories of the place. Then she zeroed in on the bad, how it marked the beginning of the end of their family and a business that is centered around alcohol. I have tried to stay open to the business, to see it as something that could be positive for our family, and have therefore not walked away, she wrote. I see now how you have really wanted me out and will most likely be pleased to receive this email. Jolie had enlisted Christophe Céline, former CEO of the venerable Bordeaux wine brand Domaine Baron de Rothschild Lafitte, as her advisor and representative, but her frustrations mounted all the same. Over time, Pitt completely froze her out, her attorneys would claim in court papers, adding that he categorically refused Jolie's request to distribute any portion of the winery's profits to her, even though she said she had invested some $60 million of her own money into it over the years. Her investment was actually $38 million, says a source close to Pitt. All dividends were reinvested back into covering cost and further improving the property and the business. Since their separation, she wrote in the email to Pitt, she had seen lots of inconsiderate behavior, money spent in ways that I would not have approved, and decisions made that I was not consulted on. She was especially shaken by the recent imagery that was released to sell the alcohol, presumably referring to a Miraval ad campaign featuring a black and white photo of Pitt asleep on a lounge chair. It reminded me of painful times. Their visions of the company were incompatible, and she wanted out. She would join him in selling the whole thing off, or she would accept a complete buyout of my share in the property and business. She asked him to decide one way or another within 2 weeks. Miraval for me died September 2016, she wrote, referring to the date of the plane meltdown, and everything I have seen in the years since has sadly confirmed that. Pitt opted to buy her half of Miraval, and in February 2021, they agreed that he would pay Jolie $54.5 million for her entire interest, including undistributed profits. The deal might have happened if not for a dispute over a non-disclosure agreement. Jolie's cross-complaint claims that after she filed a sealed document offering to prove her allegations of domestic violence as part of the child custody proceeding, Pitt demanded an NDA to prohibit Jolie from discussing outside of court any of Pitt's personal conduct toward her or the family. She called it an unconscionable gag order. A source close to Pitt says the NDA was strictly about Miraval, merely a standard precaution intended to ensure the seller doesn't damage the value of the asset after being paid for it. According to Jolie's cross-complaint, Pitt walked away from the deal when she wouldn't agree to the NDA, while Pitt's lawsuit blasted Jolie for breaking off the negotiations in retaliation for Oderkirk's joint custody ruling. Jolie petitioned the court to lift a restraining order so she could sell her stake to a third party. She quickly found an eager buyer, Tenuta del Mondo, the wine division of the SPI group, which produces and distributes Stoli Vodka and 379 other brands in 170 countries. On October 5, 2021, she sold her holding company, Nouvelle, to Tenuti del Mondo for $67 million. The buyer quickly issued a press release stating, "We are thrilled to have a position alongside Brad Pitt as curators of their extraordinary vintages." Tenuto del Mondo, it soon emerged, is controlled by a Russia-born billionaire by the name of Yuri Scheffler. For Jolie, the sale was a business transaction she had every right to make. In an effort to preserve her own mental health and well-being, she looked for and found what she believed would be a good business partner for Pitt, according to a source familiar with the matter. For Pitt, it was a betrayal. It is not a coincidence that she sold her interest in Miraval to an adversarial party and part of the family home to a stranger right after a judge granted Brad a huge win, 50-50 custody, says a source close to Pitt. Even before the divorce, Yuri Scheffler's associates were already in Provence, seeking a foothold in the rosé boom. In 2016, Sasha Lachine had received a call from Dmitry Efimov, the CEO of the SPI Group. "We represent Yuri Scheffler, and we hear you're looking for a partner," Lachine says Efimov told him. Lachine invited Efimov to the 10th anniversary party of Chateau de Clan, where he produces Whispering Angel. Scheffler's representatives were keenly interested in a partnership. Mr. Scheffler didn't demand the majority stake immediately, but wanted to see a clear path to it, says Efimov, which Lachine wasn't willing to offer. Pitt had no knowledge of Jolie's decision to sell until it was reported in the press. He was shocked by the news, Pitt would say, but he too was familiar with Scheffler. His people had approached Pitt just after the announcement of the divorce, offering 60 million euros for Miraval, according to Pitt's lawsuit. In a side deal that Pitt described as bizarre, they also offered to throw in a 50 million euro private jet for the discounted price of 23 million euros. Pitt rebuffed the offer. A Stoli Group spokesperson says the company made inquiries about acquiring Chateau Miraval in 2016, but adds Stoli is unaware of any offer involving a private jet. On February 17, 2022, 4 months after the sale was announced, Pitt filed a lawsuit against his ex-wife and Nouvelle. Scheffler, SPI, and Tenuti del Mondo were later added to the suit. Filed in California, the suit sought to nullify the sale of Jolie's 50% of Miraval. In a separate suit, filed in Luxembourg, Pitt claimed that the transfer of 10% of Miraval to Jolie in 2013 should be null and void because she never paid the 1 euro price, and even if she had, it wouldn't be an admissible amount under Luxembourg law. In both suits, Pitt insisted she had no right to sell 50% of Miraval, since they had each agreed not to sell without the other's consent, and were entitled to a right of first refusal over any sale. He argued that Jolie's sale of her half of Miraval was unlawful, and he demanded damages in an amount to be proven at trial. What Jolie had sold wasn't merely a vineyard, his lawsuit said, but Pitt's passion and a profitable one, as Miraval, under Pitt's stewardship, has grown into a multi-million-dollar global business and one of the world's most highly regarded producers of rosé wine. As for Jolie, the lawsuit claimed, she had contributed nothing to Miraval's success. A source familiar with the matter disputes this, saying that Jolie made many contributions, financial and otherwise, and her role in marketing the wine was instrumental in increasing sales. In the California suit, Pitt complained of a Jolie-led conspiracy, which included selling her stake without his knowledge in order to inflict harm on Pitt. The sale, he charged, sought to force Pitt into partnership with a stranger, and worse yet, a stranger with poisonous associations and intentions. It added that she knew and intended that Scheffler and his affiliates would try to control the business Pitt had built and to undermine Pitt's investment in Miraval. But who was Scheffler, really? As with everything, the two sides have opposing views. In his lawsuit, Pitt insists Scheffler gained notoriety through cutthroat business tactics and dubious professional associations, and said the U.S. Treasury Department designated Scheffler as an oligarch in the Russian Federation. A spokesperson for Stoly Group says the Treasury list identified high-net-worth Russians and explicitly states that it does not indicate sanctionable conduct or involvement in malign activities, adding, Scheffler categorically rejects the suggestion that his business practices or professional associations are anything other than reputable. Pitt argued that the purported sale Jolie orchestrated behind Pitt's back poses an immediate threat to Miraval's business and carefully honed brand by aligning it with a brand so synonymous with Russia that pouring Stoly vodka down the drain became a symbol of solidarity with Ukraine, according to Pitt's complaint. For Jolie, as outlined in her cross-complaint, the sale was about freedom. After Jolie filed for divorce, everything changed. Pitt kept all the properties, and Jolie's assets were largely tied up in Chateau Miraval. Not only did Stoly pay substantially more, $67 million, than Pitt was willing to pay, $54.4 million, Stoly could readily increase the prestige, distribution, and profitability of Chateau Miraval financially, benefiting Pitt and ultimately their children. 1 year after Jolie sold her share of Miraval to Stoly, the new owners of Nouvelle filed a scorching cross-complaint against Pitt, Perrin, their associates, and companies, seeking damages for the illegal and malicious actions of Pitt and his allies to injure Nouvelle by devaluing its investments and depriving it of its proper role in the management of Chateau Miraval, the world-famous producer of rosé wine. Ever since his former wife, Angelina Jolie, filed for divorce from him in 2016, Brad Pitt has been waging a vindictive war against her and Nouvelle, her former investment company, the complaint began. As for Scheffler, the cross-complaint insisted that he wasn't in any way aligned with Russian President Vladimir Putin. He was a leading critic. He and Putin were in such open conflict that Putin's people once even tried to kidnap Scheffler. From exile, Scheffler has repeatedly stood up to Putin and his regime, the cross-complaint noted, adding that he had publicly condemned Putin's invasion of Ukraine and had financed meals for the Ukrainian people through the World Central Kitchen. As for his company's reputation in the wine and beverage world, the cross-complaint cited its partnerships with everyone from PepsiCo to Pernod Ricard and Diageo. Decrying the claim that Scheffler is a Putin ally is categorically false, the suit demanded. Damages in an amount to be proven at trial of at least $250 million. Pitt's demonization of Scheffler was an effort to further distract from and excuse his own misconduct, Nouvelle's cross-complaint said. It's not Stoly Group or Scheffler whose reputation poses commercial risk to Chateau Miraval. It is his own. A source close to Pitt says Stoly's allegations are completely without basis. A month later, on October 4, 2022, Jolie filed a cross-complaint of her own in which she addressed not only their embattled rosé empire, but the fateful airplane incident that had driven the couple apart. She began with the Miraval estate. Like all couples, they divided their responsibilities. Jolie said she had made her career as an actor or director secondary to her primary responsibility of raising the children. While Pitt continued his Hollywood career and took primary responsibility for renovating the chateau, The original idea was to transform the chateau into a family home and a place to host retreats and meetings to support the couple's humanitarian and philanthropic endeavors. Still, along with her money, Jolie used her name and image to help elevate the winery's status and prestige in hopes that it would serve as a loving home for their children as well as provide for their long-term financial security. Regarding Pitt's claim that neither party would sell their share without the other's consent, she said that premise is false. No such agreement ever existed. Pitt's beloved rosé operation was now under constant attack, his lawsuit claimed. Jolie's sale to Scheffler's company had wreaked havoc on its affairs and exposed its confidential information to exploitation by a hostile competitor who had set about destabilizing Miraval's operations and seeking access to Miraval's confidential and proprietary information for the benefit of his competing enterprise. It was a multi-pronged offensive, the suit claimed, designed to seize control of Miraval. The Stoli Group never attempted a hostile takeover of Chateau Miraval, says a spokesperson for the company. The new owners of Jolie's share demanded access to documents that would allow Nouvelle to seek redress in France for Pitt and his allies' mismanagement. To Pitt, as spelled out in a memorandum, it was a blatant ploy to intimidate them into surrendering the business they built. On March 4, 2022, Miraval was under siege. Two court officers and an IT expert, armed with the French equivalent of a search warrant, drove through the gates and down the 2.5-mile road to Miraval. They had been dispatched by Nouvelle's new owners to conduct what French law translated literally calls a spontaneous interpolation. To Pitt and his partners, it was nothing short of a raid, although the Stoli Group disputes that characterization. It was not a raid, the spokesperson says, but rather a bailiff's mission, precisely and narrowly foreseen by the judge. Lawyers for Scheffler's wine division had petitioned a commercial court in Provence to invoke Article 145 of the Code of Civil Procedure, which enables businesses to enter the premises of their adversaries and seize evidence of suspected malfeasance. The filing before the court cited mismanagement, misuse of corporate assets, and a blocking mechanism by its other 50% shareholder, Mondo Bongo, the company that held Pitt's Miraval shares, in conjunction with two associates at the winery. Given the existing links between the different protagonists, it is to be feared that they will consult each other in order to conceal evidence, the petition read. It went on to say that only a spontaneous interpolation, without the recipients of it being notified in advance, would enable the court to collect the relevant evidence. When their first request was denied, the lawyers petitioned the court again. In February 2022, the bailiff granted an order to proceed. Now the court's emissaries entered the offices of the historic wine estate. They seized Miraval's files and copies of contracts, invoices, correspondence, including emails, and turned it all over to the court, which would investigate and decide whether or not to pass the materials on to Nouvelle. Neither Pitt nor Perrin were at Miraval at the time. In March of this year, the president of the commercial court issued a ruling to retract the order for the search and ensure the restitution of the documents. Nevertheless, Miraval's records remain in the hands of the court, as yet unopened. This procedure is pending before the Court of Appeal of Aix-en-Provence, says a Stoli spokesperson. In the years since the plane incident, Jolie has shifted her focus, according to a source familiar with the matter. In addition to continuing her global humanitarian work, she began advocating for survivors of domestic violence. She spoke before members of the Senate and House and campaigned on behalf of the Violence Against Women Act, the Justice for All Act, which protects the rights of crime victims, and Caden's Law, also known as Keep Your Children Safe from Family Violence. She also partnered with Amnesty International to write a book for young people called Know Your Rights and Claim Them. Coverage of Jolie's account of the plane incident prompted an outcry on social media as fans of both parties digested the shocking details. And yet, in Hollywood, Pitt remains golden. In 2019, he reteamed with Quentin Tarantino in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, co-starring opposite Leonardo DiCaprio as a handsome, aging stuntman trying to make sense of the swinging 60s. Pitt's laid-back charm earned him critical acclaim and an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. The battle rages on. On June 1st, Pitt filed an amended complaint against his ex-wife and Nouvelle's new owners, continuing his campaign to have Jolie's sale to Scheffler's company reversed. That kicked off another round of headlines, with Jolie's attorney telling CNN that Pitt has never publicly denied the accusations of assault on the plane. Brad has owned everything he's responsible for from day one, but he's not going to own anything he didn't do, says Pitt's attorney Ann Kiley. This case has been covered as a celebrity divorce. It is really a story about abuse, says a source familiar with the matter. For some, it's simply a human tragedy. I hope you'll give some grace to somebody who had a breakdown, says one person who knew the family. Everybody was shocked by the eruption on the plane, because Brad is not an abusive person. But even more devastating was what came afterwards, Brad being alienated from those he loves most, his children. In May, Miraval was named the most desirable Provence rosé wine in the world, number one in a Le Figaro magazine ranking of 33 top Provençal vineyards. And while the family that created modern-day Miraval is gone, signs of the happy life they lived here remain in an all-white bedroom with furniture designed by Pitt. This is for the kids. Everything was for the kids in the family, says someone in the chateau, leading the way into the magical bedroom located inside a building where the children were privately schooled by teachers who traveled with them from the U.S. Three of the children are now over 18, but the rest live with their mother, and Pitt shares custody and visits them. But their memory remains in this room, with its circle of white bunk beds adorned with teddy bears and other reminders of another time. Six bunk beds now lying empty where six kids once slept. None have returned to Miraval since they left in September 2016. the golden dream. California knows its state in crisis. Its leaders know, its residents know, the rest of the country knows. But how it got here, and whether the way out is any kind of model to follow, nobody can agree on, by Joe Hagan, with photographs by Tim Davis. Opening photo, a strip mall in Pismo Beach on the Central Coast. She arrives, queen-like, in a designer Italian overcoat, high collar and sunglasses, lipstick smile at once warm and fixed. An aide guides her by the elbow, security detail in tow, to the dining room of Pier 23, an old-school San Francisco tavern in the Embarcadero, with a stuffed marlin on the wall and a multi-story cruise ship idling outside. Two workmen in day-glow safety coats crane their necks from the bar to see Nancy Pelosi, Madam Speaker, Doyenne of San Francisco, bête noire of the right. Pelosi removes her shades and requests a bowl of vanilla ice cream with chocolate sauce on top. A lot of chocolate, she orders. I ask her if she's been briefed on the subject of today's interview. Her press man told her I was writing about California, she says with a knowing twinkle, and how magnificent it is, and how it is the leader in the world. Yes and no. Once in a while, an East Coast journalist will come out to California to find out what's happening in the land of dreams. As Los Angeles goes, so goes the nation. If San Francisco loses its charm, what then? It's what's coming next for you, Pelosi says portentously. Earlier that afternoon, I'd walked through the Tenderloin and seen drug addicts splayed out on street corners, and 100 human tragedies strewn across UN Plaza, City Hall looming helplessly in the background. Dickens meets Dante. Oh, it's sad, Pelosi remarks. It's worse now. That morning, after a freak snowfall, I'd hiked to the top of Mount Tamalpais in Marin County to survey the preposterous beauty of California and found a snowman with a frown carved into its face. A couple of days ago was the coldest day in like 150 years, Pelosi notes. Well, it is what it is, she shrugs, and tells me how the Spanish missionaries used to follow their livestock to the warmest grazing area with water and then build their settlement, which is how San Francisco got the Mission District. No snowmen down there. We consider it heaven on earth, she says of her kingdom. Just start at the beginning. The gold rush, the movies, agriculture throughout, and now technology. And technology is just, we haven't seen nothing yet. Technology continues to grow. So, economically, for our country, this is where most of it starts. Setting aside that California started with the decimation of indigenous people by those missionaries following their cattle, it's also the engine room of the modern Democratic Party, soon to be the fourth largest economy in the world, bigger than Germany's, and lousy with tech billionaires and Hollywood honchos. And ever since Speaker Pelosi began muscling more seats into Congress decades ago, California has shaped progressive policy, from the environment to gun control to gay and trans rights. I mean, so many people just flock here to raise money and find kindred souls in terms of the environmental, the LGBTQ, the fairness, health care, you name the subject, saving the planet, whatever it is, she continues. It's not really pragmatic money. Governor Gavin Newsom has upped the ante by branding California the true freedom state, a rejoinder to Governor Ron DeSantis' freedom state slogan, pitching Florida as a kind of anti-woke protectorate. Newsom, perhaps teasing a future White House bid, offers California as the left-wing alternative, a liberal's shining city on a hill, where diversity and tolerance, science and innovation, money and opportunity form a cutting-edge vision of America. I ask Pelosi what she makes of the motto. I would like to think of our whole country as a freedom country, she says, but we, California, certainly lead the way in everything. The Golden State has always been as much an idea as a place, a fantasy land for Easterners to pine for and put down. As a model for America, however, it's giving off decidedly mixed signals. Encampments of homeless people, floods and mudslides, drought and wildfires, earthquakes and depleted waterways, home invasions and mass shootings, tech layoffs, and entertainment and teacher strikes, drained government coffers and spooky economic shutters. If, as one Democratic consultant told me, California is the coming attractions for America, it looks like a trailer for Mad Max PCH. People living under bridges and climatological disasters are sobering counterfactuals to the California dream and also wrenches in the liberal machinery. Increasingly, among Democrats, there is a call for greater toughness. Fear, as Pelosi knows, is contagious. And the biggest challenge to California, she says, is safety. Democrats, says Pelosi, might have captured the House last year if New York's governor hadn't misread the political winds on the issue of crime. They lost 4 seats, and the governor came within 4 points, she notes. It was terrible on the issue of safety. Whether you want to call it homelessness or drug use or whatever it is, she says, safety is the oath we take to protect and defend. Yes, the Constitution, but the people. And how do you do that? Respectful of people's rights, but also respectful of their safety. Trying to write about the whole of California is akin to the proverbial blind man trying to describe an elephant. But California, by any measure, is undergoing a vibe shift. As a pal of mine in San Francisco put it, the liberal atom has been split. At the top of a hill in Simi Valley, north of Los Angeles, the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library looks out on a dramatic rust-colored landscape out of a John Ford Western. At the entrance stands a 7.5-foot bronze statue of the 40th president in his iconic ranch wear, cowboy hat, and serenely vacant smile, a vintage vision of California's manifest destiny. At the foot of the same hill is Reaganism's 21st century progeny, a gun range operated by Taron Butler, a 57-year-old sharpshooting champion who has made a name training action stars and social media influencers to shoot high-powered pistols and semi-automatic rifles. Butler, who looks like a mashup of Jack Black and Steven Seagal, grew up in 1970s Hollywood and became enamored with guns after seeing Magnum Force, the rogue cop flick with Clint Eastwood as Dirty Harry. His first gun was the same model Colt Python that Eastwood briefly used in Butler's favorite scene. Butler set out to become the fastest gun in the West and has the trophy to show for it. When the pandemic hit, crime fears spiked and lines formed at gun stores. A new generation of social media apps, Citizen, originally named Vigilante, and Next Door, let people report break-ins, smash-and-grab robberies, and home invasions as random violence, like the murder of philanthropist Jacqueline Avant in her Beverly Hills home, made headlines. Violent crime in L.A. County climbed 7.3% in 2020-21, the Public Policy Institute of California noted. As police staffing declined. Next photo, novelist Rachel Kushner in her 1964 Galaxy 500 in downtown Los Angeles. There are bad people in the world breaking into houses, and they'll take your stuff and they'll shoot you, whether you beg them not to or not, says Butler. So if the police can't get there, the police are unable to get there, and people are wanting to not have police anymore, whatever. So now it's just up to you to defend yourself. Butler asked me to imagine a scenario where I'm trapped in the corner of a room and someone is coming into the house to kill me. What's better, he argues. You just die? Is that a better end, like in a movie? Is that a better ending? That Hollywood logic has hit home with celebrities who started showing up to the range in droves. Jamie Foxx, Dwayne Johnson, Rob Lowe, a bunch of Kardashians, James Cameron, Joe Rogan. Butler Tools and sells boutique Glocks for the John Wick franchise, starring Keanu Reeves, another frequent guest at the range. Donald Trump Jr. bought a John Wick Combat Master with his name inscribed on the handle. At an NRA convention, Butler called it an honor. Post Malone bought two. When I show up to the range, Butler instructs me using the Pit Viper from John Wick, Chapter 4. He tells me to fire at human-shaped targets, and I pop off double burst in quick succession as he narrates, "Nice shot, now get the next guy, that's his brother, and he's mad." Butler also hosts a bevy of Instagram influencers, some aspiring actresses who make videos of themselves in skin-tight outfits blasting targets with John Wick-branded guns. A flat-screen TV in Butler's open-air shed cycles through clips of his fiancée, a 29-year-old actor and influencer from Ukraine named Tatiana Gadar, performing fight scenes. Snoop Dogg once reposted a video of Gaidar doing eyebrow-raising splits. But by far the most popular influencer in Butler's orbit is Tony McBride, a 26-year-old officer in the Los Angeles Police Department with 122,000 followers on Instagram. I first saw McBride in a video wearing Daisy Duke cutoffs while firing two Glocks with shoulder braces and bump stocks attached, bullet casings spraying out in slow motion to the strains of Mozart's Requiem Mass in D minor, as McBride grins maniacally. It was more than just a Quentin Tarantino movie come to life. While on duty one afternoon in South Central in the spring of 2020, McBride killed a 38-year-old Latino man named Daniel Hernandez. Her body cam footage, later released on YouTube by the LAPD, echoes her post from Butler's range. McBride aims her Glock at her target, a man suffering a meth-induced mental break after attempting to kill himself with a box cutter, and pops off three double burst, six bullets in all, the last a direct hit to the head, killing Hernandez as onlookers scream in horror from the sidewalks. A month later, George Floyd was murdered in Minneapolis, and the Tony McBride case went viral. Hashtag Black Lives Matter, hashtag Police Brutality, hashtag Hollywood, hashtag California. Next photos. Simi Valley's Happy Face Hill, smiling since 1998. And Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi in San Francisco. In South Central, on the corner of 32nd and San Pedro, I meet Cerise Castle, a 38-year-old investigative reporter, who shows me the spot where McBride killed Hernandez, middle of a quiet boulevard with a car wash and a bodega. A road sign nearby advertises Byrna Self-Defense, a non-lethal gun that shoots plastic projectiles. Castle, who writes for progressive hyperlocal news sites LA Taco and Knock LA, calls the McBride case a classic example of police brutality against black and brown people. Cops escalating violence and no justice for families. Anytime the police kill someone, I think it's unnecessary, she says. They're not supposed to be arbiters of justice. McBride kept her job after a five-person commission determined that only the last two of her six shots were out of policy. The family of Daniel Hernandez sued. A judge threw the lawsuit out, citing qualified immunity, and the case is now under appeal. Arnaldo Casillas, a lawyer for the family, told me the Hernandez killing was a direct result of McBride's training at Butler's Range. Casillas later introduced me to Hernandez's sister, Marina, who through tears asked, "How do you have this person who's an influencer, who's promoting violence and high-powered guns? There's only one use for them. That's to shoot and kill people. That's the message she's giving. How is that tolerated? How is that just?" The same week that a mass shooter killed 11 people in Monterey Park, Butler was at a gun show in Las Vegas presenting a new AR-15 rifle to Kyle Rittenhouse. The vigilante turned right-wing media star alongside McBride, who applauded while Rittenhouse grinned with his new gun. Defending her, Butler asked, Do you think it's good that the police now are scared too, that recruitment's way down? LA has got nobody coming to work, and the police are scared to get involved to help anybody because they're going to maybe lose their career, their whole livelihood, if they handle it the wrong way, accidentally. In California, crime is a battle of perception. Everybody has their own storytelling apparatus and their own stats. Castle dismisses LAPD crime numbers as propaganda, believing they're padded to rationalize force or to pressure politicians to allocate more money. I mean, they always want crime to be up, she says. She puts little hope in the new mayor of LA, Karen Bass, who, despite being a liberal Democrat and former head of the Congressional Black Caucus, Castle says never really said that she was going to be an accountability figure for the LAPD. She campaigned on expanding the LAPD, on giving the LAPD more money. In the McBride case, critics like Castle also see a thumb on the scale of justice. McBride's father, Jamie McBride, is a director of Los Angeles Police Protective League, infamous for his own 6 shootings in the line of duty and for inveighing against the Black Lives Matter protest. His rallying cry for local police, hold the line. Incidentally, Jamie is also an actor and film consultant who worked on the last Michael Bay film, Ambulance. He was the original cop influencer in their family, Castle says. Another of his daughters, Jacqueline, also with the LAPD, was among the 3 officers who shot and killed a woman in the line of duty in February. Castle refers to them as the McBrides, like they're a clan on Yellowstone. Next photos, Abbott Elementary writer Brittany Nichols and Cerise Castle in their Los Angeles apartment. Factory-farmed cows in Central Valley. Congressman Ro Khanna, whose district includes Cupertino and Santa Clara, dining at the Nawab's Kitchen in Fremont. 3 years ago, Castle was covering a Black Lives Matter protest for radio station KCRW when she was hit by a rubber police bullet. Even though I identified myself as press, and I got this all on my phone, a police officer turned and shot me, she recounted. And the injuries that resulted put me on bed rest for about 6 months. I was in a cast, and the doctor told me I couldn't work. While recuperating, she saw a TV report about a sheriff gang that allegedly required members to commit a murder to join. She became obsessed and created a 16-episode podcast series, A Tradition of Violence, The History of Deputy Gangs in the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, which details the culture of law enforcement social clubs, with names like the Executioners, the Gladiators, the Bandidos, and the Tasmanian Devils. After she published the podcast, I had to go into hiding for a little bit, Castle says. I was just getting constant death threats, specific death threats. In February, Castle won the American Mosaic Journalism Prize and signed with Creative Artist Agency for future film and TV deals. Castle maintains a growing collection of gang memorabilia, sweatshirts, collectible coins, and has a Google alert to track cop merch. Among her prized pieces, a signed black and white picture of Tony McBride in an LAPD uniform holding a rifle with the words "Hold the Line" underneath. Octavia E. Butler was asked 7 years after the publication of her uncannily predictive 1993 novel, Parable of the Sower, whether her visions of an environmentally ravaged Los Angeles circa 2024, where the elite barricade themselves in walled fortresses, surrounded by poverty-stricken encampments of drug addicts and illiterate poor, was something she really believed would happen. I didn't make up the problems, replied the writer, who grew up in Pasadena. All I did was look around at the problems we're neglecting now and give them about 30 years to grow into full-fledged disasters. If somebody is saying the crime is down, they're living in La La Land, declares Rick Caruso, the billionaire real estate developer who spent $104 million on his campaign for mayor of L.A. last year and lost. I don't think there's a category of crime that's down. I would challenge anybody to find one. I'm sitting on a veranda at Caruso's palatial estate in Brentwood, a creamy Italianate compound of rolling grasses, waterfalls, a pond, a rowboat, a tennis court, and an outdoor bar. Caruso's father was the founder of Dollar Rent-A-Car, and Caruso made billions more developing malls across the state. Before becoming president of the L.A. Police Commission in 2001, Caruso ran for mayor, promising to sweep drug dealers off the street and to stanch the exodus of small businesses through sheer force of managerial chutzpah. Last year's race was rocked by a leaked recording of three prominent Latino city council members making racist comments about black people and darker-skinned Oaxacans. Caruso suspects someone in the Bass camp leaked the audio, which he says embarrassed Latinos, his ostensible base, and dissuaded them from voting. Karen ran on identity politics, pure and simple, Caruso says. The subtitle was, "I'm a black woman, and it's time for a black woman." That resonated with a lot of younger liberal voters. Not everyone bought Caruso's conversion from registered Republican to Democrat. During his campaign, Caruso led media tours through Skid Row, the biggest encampment of homeless people in America, to show off the failures of the government. I meet him there one afternoon, along with a security detail and his personal videographer, for a ghoulish tour of makeshift tents and addicts shooting up on fold-out chairs, the rank odor of garbage and human feces everywhere. A tattoo-faced dude gets in Caruso's grill to complain about his application for Section 8 housing, and another yells out to him, "Hey, Mayor!" "Maybe next time," says Caruso. Skid Row has existed since the late 19th century and expanded to swallow up 50 square blocks in downtown L.A., annexed by drug gangs selling fentanyl and meth. Our guide, a rep for a local business organization, refers to the area as the Amazon Fulfillment Center for drugs. The LAPD rarely ventures inside. It's basically a free zone, Caruso says grimly. Homelessness is driving business from L.A., he says, where real estate is further blighted by the city's new 5.5% tax on the proceeds of any real estate transaction over $10 million. So you could sell something at a loss and still pay the tax, he marvels. It applies to every building, every commercial building, every residential building. So now, why would you invest in L.A.? Why are you going to build something in L.A.? Before we leave, he tells me a story about his friend Ted Sarandos, the co-CEO of Netflix and son-in-law of Jacqueline Avant, the home invasion victim, who put the media company's offices downtown to try to revitalize an otherwise seedy neighborhood. When the pandemic ended and people started coming back to office, they were bringing so much feces in that everybody was getting sick in the offices, says Caruso. So everybody had to bring extra pairs of shoes. A Netflix spokesperson says the anecdote is inaccurate, but that Sarandos had related a similar story to Caruso about a different entertainment company. To put a fine point on it, Caruso's aide offers me a Clorox wipe. I disinfect the bottom of my sneakers before heading to the Hollywood Hills for a dinner party at Susan Orlean's house. Next photos, a fisherman at the Santa Monica Beach. California Republic flags caught in the wind outside of the Reagan Library. Dancers in traditional Jalisco dresses in Santa Ana. A film production at Point Doom in Malibu. Flamingos mingle at the L.A. Zoo. Actor Tatiana Gaidar at her fiancé Taron Butler's shooting range in Simi Valley. Sunset view of the San Francisco skyline from Interstate 580. Comedian Sheng Wang in Culver City. Sunrise over a motel in Bristol. A coyote decoy stands guard at the Livermore Lab. Los Angeles City Council member Nithya Raman, who ran on housing reform in her office at City Hall. The home of the best-selling author of The Orchid Thief and the library book is an architectural marvel designed by maverick architect Rudolf Schindler and built in 1946 for Misha Callis, an art director for Universal Studios. The living room glows with an orangey hue that Benjamin Moore might dub Golden Dream, and guests ooh and ah over the angular beams, mid-century furniture, and breathtaking views of L.A. at night, including fireworks bursting over Universal every few minutes. Over lemon chicken piccata and an Alexander Valley Cabernet, I recount my time on Butler's Gun Range. Barry Weiss, the contrarian podcaster, is a relative newcomer to California, arriving during the pandemic with her girlfriend, now wife, the writer Nellie Bowles. One of the things that has shocked me about living in Los Angeles, Weiss says, is how many people who are not at all politically conservative own guns here. Orleans points out that Bass, the mayor, owns guns. Karen Bass owns guns? Asked Bowles. Yeah, they were stolen from her house, says Mayor Roshan, the then editor-in-chief of Los Angeles Magazine. Bowles says her father bought the couple an impractical home security device, fearing for their safety. I, under no circumstances, want a gun at all, says Orlean. Roshan mentions that Butler's Range in Simi Valley is always sold out. It's the finale of White Lotus, guys, Weiss riffs. Come on. Earlier that week, I'd heard from business owners in Sherman Oaks that crime is so rampant, everyone was developing a home invasion plan. An architect named Barbara and her daughter, Charlotte, who goes to Brown, say that's ridiculous. They leave their front doors unlocked. You know what, interjects Orlean, we were very casual, and then we got robbed in Montecito. She and her husband, the financier John Gillespie Jr., were renovating another house when somebody ran off with $35,000 worth of plumbing materials, including two toilets. Their neighborhood WhatsApp group reports disoriented people roaming the hills. Some people are saying, I paid this amount of money for my house, and I don't want to deal with a disheveled guy trying my garage door, Orlean says. We talk about crime all the time, says Bowles. She receives regular email blasts about crime in her neighborhood. There's constant break-ins. It's almost every house, says Weiss, adding, when you see a guy walking down the street in broad daylight, swinging a machete, and you call the police and they say they can't come, something is wrong in your city. Listening quietly is Nithya Raman, the city councilwoman who represents Orleans District. Raman, a Harvard graduate and urban planner, whose husband was a writer for Modern Family on ABC, has been a lightning rod for her liberal views on homelessness, which less generous critics interpret as defending the rights of vagrants to live on other people's porches. Last year, a restaurateur in Sherman Oaks sent Raman's office a photograph of what the person called a dirty, disgusting, drunken, naked homeless female passed out on the entrance door and driving away customers. Raman's office responded with sympathy, but also anger, for triggering Raman's staff with an image of a nude woman on the sidewalk. I talk to people all the time, constituents who are very worried about the state of Los Angeles, Raman says. I think the perceptions of crime are exacerbated by a feeling of disorder on our streets. Raman isn't eager to talk about crime. She did, after all, call for defunding the police in 2020. She says the homelessness epidemic, nearly 42,000 people live outside in the city of L.A. alone, can make crime feel like an epidemic. A story about crime is more believable when you feel like we don't have a city that's working well, Raman observes. That story falls on more fertile ground. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.